Dr. Amalia Gonyas-Malka. Welcome to Womanity, Woman in Unity, the show that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in their struggles for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, democracy, racism, socioeconomic class division, and gender-based violence. Joining us today is Mrs. Geraldine Fraser-Moleketi, the African Development Bank Special Envoy on Gender. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, and it's really good to be able to speak to you. I've listened to you over a long period, and I think it's really great to be with you today.
Mrs. Fraser-Moleketi is the Special Gender Envoy at the African Development Bank. She previously held the position of Director of the United Nations Development Programme's Democratic Governance Group, overseeing the organization's related strategic and policy work in 197 countries and territories around the globe. She was appointed by the Secretary General of the United Nations as a board member of the United Nations Institute for Training and Research. And prior to joining the United Nations Development Programme, she served as Minister for Public Service and Administration in South Africa from 1999 through to 2008, and as Minister for Welfare and Population Development from 1996 to 1999. She has also served as the National Deputy Elections Coordinator for the African National Congress from 1993-1994 in the lead-up to South Africa's first democratic elections. What an incredible track record.
Thank you. I think it's humbling to listen to it, but I think we should bear in mind there are a number of South Africans and Africans who have even more illustrious stories and histories. So see, this is part of a small contribution to the broader transformation and change, not only in our own country, South Africa, but towards change on the African continent.
And within your career, there have been a number of different landmarks. Can you please share what has impacted on you the most?
You know, that's a very difficult question, because I can go back in time and back to my childhood, and I can touch on one thing there. I'm from a family that I think contributed quite a lot to my upbringing, my socialization, the kind of role that I played in the communities that I lived in and all. And that's due to the fact that my father is from a little village in the Eastern Cape, and he's from a family that was impacted upon very directly by race laws in South Africa. His grandmother was indigenous Xhosa, a woman from the Eastern Cape. His grandfather was a Scottish soldier that was on the paternal side. On his maternal side, his grandmother was also indigenous to the Eastern Cape, and his grandfather was Irish, was an Irish minister. My mother was, on the other hand, from the Western Cape. Her mother was a trade unionist, and she was responsible for building the first trade union in the fireworks area in a factory. So she came from that background and so on. But shaping my background was coming from that kind of background that was already a cauldron of South Africa, you know, South Africans from all parts, the Western Cape, the Eastern Cape, and clearly with a focus on social justice. And as my husband, Jabu Moleketi, said when one of my cousins got married in the 90s, he said to her husband, "You're actually marrying into a family that was non-racial when non-racialism wasn't a fashion." You know, and not that it's the fashion now, but it was at the time when it was a risk to be there. I think there was always this issue of ensuring that we'd make a difference and look at how you reject what was the convention at the time. So at the age of 14, I was at high school and stayed with my grandmother, myself and my two siblings. So my father was a school principal out of Cape Town, sort of more peri-urban Cape Town then. So we stayed with my grandmother, the firebrand trade unionist, you know, and we used to take a bus to Livingston High School, which was in Claremont. When you got on the bus, it was about, I think it's about a 10-kilometer ride. I can't remember. So we got into the bus at the first stop. And Livingston was almost the one but last stop. So when you get into the bus, we all had seats. And at that point, the front four seats were reserved for white people. And the rest of the bus was open to non-whites at that point in time. So, of course, we get in the morning, certain, just early in the morning. And as soon as the bus fills up with workers on their way to work, those days, it was just courtesy to stand up for adults. And I think one fine morning, I was just fed up because, of course, you know, we had to stand up and there were the four empty seats. So around Philippi area, I actually sat in those seats and the driver said, you better get up. And I said, no, I'm not getting up. And he stopped the bus and he said, you've got to get up. And there were the adults, workers, said, look, you better get up. You're making us late for work and all. And I said, I'm not getting up. Now, you've seen me today. I'm not particularly big. At 14, I think I was even smaller. The driver came into the bus and physically lifted me out and left me on the side of the road. So there I was.
Booted me out.
This was 1974. So I was 14 then. And fortunately, my Afrikaans subject teacher at the time, Mr. Jacobs, was courting his later wife at that time. So he had spent the night in the area. And he saw from my blazer that I was from Livingston because, of course, the blazer was very clearly marked at the school. And he stopped and he saw it was me. And he said in Afrikaans, and I'll repeat it in English, he said, Geraldine, your oor vlam, wat makeer, you know, your eyes are flashing, what's wrong? And I explained the story. And, of course, that was my first little public action of civil disobedience. They got me booted out of the bus. I didn't have money for another bus, and generally the buses were full there. It was a clip card system those days, so my card had been clipped for going. And there it was, and I think that was an action that we'd see later in life. I was also in the high school Scholars of Student Representative Council. I actually ran for president and lost against someone called Russell Ali. And that was my first lesson because I spoke about South African politics. And of course, all that the students wanted to know about was, so what are you going to do about having access to a better tuck shop or maybe improving the library or something like that.
So that was very small scale and yours
and was much bigger.
Much larger.
Because that was where, at the time when there were the talks for what was then the then Southwest Africa, and there was this whole discussions with the Turinala Alliance. But I think I'm spending too much time on those years, but that informed it. So came 1976. And you'd recall that the uprising started in Soweto and then moved to the rest of the country. As a school, we got involved with those activities.
We'll be right back after this.
Hi, I'm Zonke Digana, a South African Afro-soul musician, songwriter and producer. You are listening to Womanity, Women in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance.
You are listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance, on frequency 9625 kHz on the 31-meter band. We would love to receive your comments on Twitter at Womanity Talk. If you've just tuned in, we're talking to Mrs. Geraldine Fraser-Moliketi, Special Envoy on Gender for the African Development Bank. Now, picking up on our discussion.
Later, I went into exile, and I think I'm going to highlight two things from exile. The one issue is that I worked very closely with a member of the leadership of the African National Congress, Joe Kabi, and he was assassinated in July of 1981 in Harare, and it was one of those extrajudicial killings by the then South African regime against leaders of and members of the African National Congress or the band organizations that were operating from neighboring countries. And that's quite a story. That needs a special interview. But I think that very much stuck in my mind. And I was 21 at the time when the assassination took place. And I think the anger also just increased my resolve to work towards building a democracy. So these killings that took place didn't have the effect of causing fear. It actually increased resolve to build society that was a just society, social and economically just. And I think that's also where the whole issue of equality comes into play. So, you know, the whole issue of ensuring that you overcome inequalities in society, that there is really inclusion and that men and women should be treated equally as should black and white people, that there should not be discrimination against people because of their disabilities, or even for that matter, because of their sexual orientation. You know, you should not have any form of discrimination in society. I had a privilege to be elected to parliament and be one of the pioneers of a democratic parliament. Also have the honour and privilege to serve both as Deputy Minister for Welfare in 1995 to 96, later Minister in the cabinet of President Nelson Mandela, and then in subsequent cabinets of the two cabinets of President Thabo Mbeki as Minister for Public Service and Administration. And I think the big lesson for me, having worked in those cabinets, those executives, having served in the first three parliaments, was the need to serve and serve the people of South Africa and the challenges that go with that. You know, you are in a position where you are a role model, whether you choose that or not. And public service means that you sacrifice what you may consider private, your private life. And I think that's quite noble on the one hand, but I think it's but a small contribution when you look at what a large contribution people have made to ensure that we do have a democracy in this country. Our democracy did not come free. It came at a great cost. This is something to consider. And I mean, we walk on the shoulders of men and women who have come before us. And as someone said in recent times, you know, we haven't inherited this land of ours. We haven't inherited this environment. We are actually just protectors for the next generation.
That's an interesting expression, protectors for the next generation. But I think through everything that you've mentioned, your focus and your resolve has really been on a bigger picture of things. It hasn't been looking at things on a short term. It's going above and beyond. To go back briefly, you mentioned the first encounter at 14, then another significant encounter with the assassination happening when you were 21 years old. None of those seemed to weaken your resolve, but if anything, made you more determined to go ahead and to change the world for the better.
Yes, but I think I look at it as well as the whole issue of a responsibility that we have. I also say to the younger generation, there is always a struggle, and a struggle for social justice. And we must look at the struggle in the most positive of senses. We don't look at it as a destructive and negative struggle that we engaged in as we fought apartheid. And at this point, the struggle in South Africa is a struggle for reconstruction, a struggle for development. And that's a struggle on the African continent as well, transforming the African economy, ensuring that inclusive growth is inclusive, that it includes men and women, that young people are part of inclusive growth story, that story will be one that 10, 20 years down the line, when you talk about inclusive growth on the African continent, you don't talk about consistent growth of 6% over a decade, and that this will continue and it should have an impact on the broader population to ensure that they have livelihoods. We should ensure that this growth story is, we talk about much higher levels of growth, because otherwise we won't overcome the battle of poverty and inequality in society. But this growth story is also not just for a few. It's a story that will
also ensure that the woman in the far north of our country, that she's not just going to engage in microfinancing and look at sustainable incomes that are survivalist, but that she is able to get into the mainstream economy. And if she is selling tomatoes and other cash crops, she must actually get into agribusiness. And that 10 years down the line, we talk about businessmen and women across the African continent who are in clear supply chains, where they are able to, from a planting to markets, make the linkages.
So they own that value chain and they're able to play a role throughout
the value chain. So you've asked me about my resolve. So my resolve is, and this is what I say to the next generation, that there's always a struggle, but let's understand what it is. And at this point, the struggle is to overcome inequalities in society, and let's make that happen. And every challenge you face must be a challenge that makes you stronger. Let me give you another example. When I was Minister for Public Service, I was quite known not for the broader work around trying to build a professional public service, but people remembered me for the engagement with trade unions once every 3 years. So someone referred to me as the Iron Lady and see it in a particular frame, but not understand that that engagement was not anti-workers or against the trade union movement. It was one that said, there is a particular budget that we have in South Africa. That budget is finite. And public service workers are getting a slice from the country budget. Their money does not come from profits. It's from what's in the fiscus. And we need to ensure that that slice is so divided that it is not competing with other priorities in society. There was a great pushback, and there was, in instances, very sexist comments where they would say, where there was a poster that said, "Jabu keep Geraldine in the kitchen." And it was Steve Chwete, who was Minister of Safety and Security at the time, who said to the workers, "You take down that poster. We are not going to have a discussion, and we won't accept the memorandum you want to hand over until that poster goes." So, I mean, it was easy enough for me to say, oh, gosh, this is so personal. It is such a direct attack on being a woman.
And that would never have happened for
and
a man.
It would not have happened because a man would have been seen as firm.
Yes.
They would seem as being able to handle authority and power and very clearly, you know, drawing a line on it. But it was very different. But I was not going to be cowed by that because at the end of the day, I was very clear that it was a collective decision. My engagement was not a personal engagement, and it was also not about me. It was about the larger public good. But I think, secondly, what was overlooked at the time was what were the changes that we were bringing about? Because we changed the conditions of service for all public service. It was during that period that men and women earned the same salary in the public service, where there was equal pay for jobs of equal value. And as South Africa, we even led European governments on this.
But no one spoke about that.
Yes, nobody spoke about that at the time. The point I'm making is, you can either say, this is so difficult that I'm not going to take it on, or you say, I'm going to engage all stakeholders. Let me make a last point. In 1995, I was the deputy leader of the South African delegation to Beijing. Dr. Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma, the now chair of the African Union Commission, she was the leader of the delegation at the time. But you know, we had a process for 1995 throughout, up to the Beijing process, the Beijing summit itself, where we looked at a plan of action that would form part of what became the Beijing Platform of Action. And you know, the one thing that South Africa can be proud of is that we went as South Africans to all parts of this country, all 9 provinces, and through meetings that were multi-party as well. We met with women organizations in civil society. We met with sectors, academia and others. We looked at the private sector to engage them in developing a platform of action. And that became the country strategy. We made our inputs as a country to what was formative to a global women's agenda that was adopted. I think at this point in time, there's many concerns of many of us who've been part of the global women's movement that we're actually having to fight to retain a lot of what was put in that platform of action. And we're looking at how to deepen it. But there's also very positive parts. Because Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, as chair of the AUC, is very clear about what inclusion is about, I think there should be an announcement very soon about the way in which this year will be commemorated across the African continent. So many journeys, many challenges, great progress in instances, but sometimes concerns that they may be clawing back.
We'll be right back after this.
Hi, this is Lira, South African Afro-Soul singer and songwriter. You're listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, presented by Dr. Amalia Malka on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance, a program that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in their struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, and democracy.
Today, we're talking to Mrs. Geraldine Fraser-Moliketi, Special Envoy on Gender for the African Development Bank. We would love to receive your comments on Twitter at WomanityTalk. Continuing with our discussion.
It seems to me that gender equality is increasingly becoming more of a global focus. And South Africa has done instrumental work in terms of advancing and developing various initiatives for women, and more recently in terms of the Women Empowerment and Gender Equality Bill, which is currently undergoing another round of consultation and review. But in principle, its aim is about being able to promote and achieve equality for women across the board. What are your perspectives on the aspects of the bill, and do you think that legislation helps close gender gaps?
Let me talk a little bit about the global environment, and you're absolutely right. Gender equality has become much more of reality globally, not only in the public sector of civil society, but even in the private sector. You are probably aware that Credit Suisse has come out with a study of 2,000 and about 69 companies over a period of 6 years, where they've looked at what impact does it have to have women serving boards of listed companies. And the evidence actually points to the fact that those boards that are diverse, that include women on them, that their bottom lines, their profit margins are greater. You also know that there are women in multinational private sector companies that are doing very well. So yes, it is a reality. It wasn't the case 20 years ago. It was much more difficult. The women were lonely. And we've also seen a greater movement by men and women in the private sector. So, yes, there's a much greater awareness. And I also want to talk about it in the broader sense. Legislation is an enabler. And I think affirmative legislation will serve as an enabler to ensure the involvement of marginalized sectors and communities. And in this instance, we're not talking about the minority that's been marginalized. We're talking about the majority.
In South Africa, yes. Women account for 52%
exactly.
of the population.
I mean, this is a particular reality that we're dealing with. And affirmative action interventions are not negative. There is and has always been the debate around quotas and percentages and how we deal with this particular issue, but I want to declare that I believe in quotas because I think it's the only way to make a breakthrough, because we need to redress a past. So it is positive. However, you can't stop at legislation. We've got one of the most far-reaching constitutions internationally, but we haven't necessarily seen the extent of change in all sectors of society. We've seen it through political representation, but when you look at local government, much as we have set particular targets and quotas, it's not been that easy to reach. So you need to bring together your legal instruments with a political will. And when I say political will, I'm not only talking about the head of state, government and all. I'm also talking about the political will through leadership, whether in the private sector, chairs of boards, CEOs of companies and all that. So you need that to happen. And I think the empowerment legislation is taking further what's required to create the space for women in the private sector. But there's more access to finance and women's access to finance, looking very creatively or more flexibly at what would be the asset base for women. We shouldn't only look at fixed assets.
Land and property ownership has always been an issue.
It's always been an issue. So I think we should probably look at other assets.
Whilst we're on the topic of women and development, do you think that is part of factors that contribute to your agenda as Special Envoy?
Absolutely. I mean, as a Special Envoy on Gender, I think I should just probably explain one or two things. My mandate is multiple. The one is I'm the principal spokesperson on gender for the African Development Bank. But secondly, I also have a major advocacy role. Our gender strategy stands on three pillars. That's legal status and property rights. The second pillar is, of course, women's economic empowerment. And both these pillars feed into the core business of the bank. We look at the issue of private sector and private sector development. We're also looking at regional integration and all. Now, for women to really play a role in all those sectors, you need collateral. And for collateral, the bank is going to, even as a development finance institution, when you have women fund managers coming together and saying, we want to set up an equity fund, I mean, the rules of the bank would say, we want to see the track record of that fund. Now, women don't necessarily have that track record. In South Africa, I know there's only one women-led private equity fund. One. So if women are going to set that up, they won't necessarily have the track record. So we need to review that. But I want to make a link between this challenge and the whole question of race. 10 years ago, on the African continent as a whole, there were very few African equity funds headed by men, African men. And I spoke with a very successful businessman, Papa Ndai, from Senegal. And when I spoke with him recently, Papa said to me, you know, Geraldine, the very issues that women are grappling with now is what we grappled with 10 years ago. Everyone said, you're not going to get African men in private equity. They don't have the track record. They don't have the experience. They don't have the capital. He says, 10 years later, it's not an issue because we broke through that. We forced the doors open. We made it happen. And he says that's the space women are finding themselves in. And he says, count me in as a champion to take this forward. So just coming back to your question, so does this relate to what you do? Part of my work is also looking for champions across the African continent, men and women, who are going to take this agenda forward.
But once you have an influencer who affects a particular community, that community buys into it.
Absolutely.
It's much, much easier to sell an idea onto them or philosophy.
I think it is, but on the other hand, we also need to ensure that there's ongoing sensitization. Because you could also have a backlash, because some may see this as women trying to take over men's spaces. And we are not. We are saying inclusion is about having both men and women in those spaces. Because at the end of the day, evidence also shows that when you bring women into business, and this is evidence across the world, they tend to create businesses that create more jobs. Also, the evidence shows that women are more cautious than men. And hence, when you look at equity and you look at particular funds, you need both men and women. Because women may be a bit more cautious around investment and men may be ready to jump.
One of the reasons towards the downfall of Wall Street, because it was so fueled by testosterone.
Exactly. So we need these spaces occupied. We don't want to take over male spaces and crowd them out. We want spaces to be available to everyone. So we shouldn't say this sector, the oil and gas or the mining sector, is a non-traditional sector for women. Yes, it's non-traditional at this point in time, but it shouldn't be in future. So we actually want to widen the space. We want inclusion. at the end of the day, I've got two sons and a daughter. We give birth to boys and girls, you know. And gender is about men and women. It's about looking at public policy and ensuring that that policy is equitable to both men and women. It also looks at implementation of programs and policies. And I think more broadly, it's about ensuring that we should use all our assets. That at the end of the day, the gender dividend should be a dividend that counts for the African continent. You know, there's a projection that the infrastructure deficit is about $40 billion, maybe higher. Similarly, the gender deficit is $40 billion and higher. So let's use this resource. But to use it, we've got to prevent early marriage. We've got to keep our girls in school. We've got to ensure that our girls and boys also, amongst others, study sciences, maths, and so on. We want our girls and boys to explore outer space. But above all, we want to ensure that we build inclusive societies that believe in the equality of all people.
We'll be right back after this.
Hi, my name is Yvonne Chakachaka, and I'm UNICEF and Rollback Malaria Goodwill Ambassador. You are listening to Womanity, Women in Unity, a program that celebrates prominent and ordinary African women's milestone achievements in the struggle for liberation, self-emancipation, human rights, and democracy. A program against social ills such as racism, socio-economic class division, and gender-based violence. Womanity, Women in Unity, presented by Dr. Amalia Balka every week on this day at this time.
You are listening to Womanity, Women in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance, on frequency 9625 kHz on the 31-meter band. We would love to receive your comments on Twitter at Womanity Talk. If you've just tuned in, we're talking to Mrs. Geraldine Fraser-Moliketi, Special Envoy on Gender for the African Development Bank.
We've been talking about women's development. Which areas do you think we need to build on the most to benefit women into the future?
It's a bit difficult to say which should we build on most. But let me just say, I hold a view that if you want to make change, you should also follow the money. Note I'm saying also. I'm not saying only. So it's necessary to ensure that women get into the economic sector. We had a round table yesterday where we looked at agricultural global value chains, and we had Gloria Sorobe there.
She was on my show 3 weeks ago.
3 weeks ago, yeah. Gloria was saying we shouldn't only look at changing legislation. We also need to look at who's sitting at the table in the spaces where there's money. At the end of the day, it's important to know who represents you on any fund that's yours, because it's our money. We're not talking about state money now. Pension funds in companies are funds of employees, or citizens' funds, as are the provident funds. And hence your point earlier about Wall Street and the recklessness there. This is again because you didn't have a steady handle at the wheel. So, in short, I'm saying the economic sector, the economy, we've left that too long to be a male-dominated environment. If you spoke to me 15 years ago, 20 years ago, when I was both in welfare and public sector service, and said to me, Geraldine, would you be in a development finance institution? I would have said, absolutely not. So we need to claim these spaces, and nobody's going to bring it to us. So the women must go out there and grab it, because South Africa has an enabling environment. But it's only as enabling as we will make it be. So yes, we're going to have pushback, and you are going to have instances where we will be ridiculed. Remember the poster when I was in government that said, Jabu, keep Geraldine in the kitchen? And I could have been intimidated at the time and walked away. I mean, right now, being in the African Development Bank, banking is also a contested area. We need a special dispensation so that we can use the assets that women have access to and allow them to move beyond being in small business to real business. Because as I may have said earlier, and if I have not, I'm stating it now, Africa has the highest number of entrepreneurs globally. the highest number. We beat Asia. But the African entrepreneurs are at the lowest level. So they remain in the micro sectors and in the survivalist sectors. And that's what we need to turn around. And for that to happen, for women to come out of the survivalist sectors, they must be bold enough to occupy the spaces. Because Asia beat us. Latin America beat us. We were looking at some statistics talking about successful entrepreneurship. The figures are dismal. There is a mindset that it stays on a micro level, that people aren't thinking beyond turning it into a much, much bigger business and looking long term. What's going to happen in 5 years? What's going to happen in 10 years' time? How is my business going to evolve? And it points back to all those factors you said about education,
yes,
upskilling and empowering women, and economic inclusion. And also I think about a need for cultural change. And when I talk culture, is not assuming that there are certain spaces that are women's spaces, and there are other spaces that are men's spaces. We need to change the spaces and make it people's spaces. And this is where women need to lead to occupy those spaces. If we don't step in those spaces, we're not going to be able to draw on support.
Now we're drawing to a close of the show. In closing the discussion, I'd like you to please use this platform to send a message of hope to all those women listening that due to circumstances, gender equality is probably not first on their agenda, but rather the daily struggle of taking care of their family, raising their children, and putting food on the table for them is a more pressurizing reality.
That's precisely why gender equality has got to be at the center of development. Because at the end of the day, for as long as women don't have access to productive assets, so for as long as women don't have access to running water, electricity, to infrastructure that will enable them to travel from and to work very easily, they have to spend long hours in the workspace and then long hours at home to do the unpaid work. And yes, it may be a labor of love, but a labor of love should be one where women have time to spend and enjoy with their families. That when we spend time with our children, it's not a burden. But for that to happen, our generation of women and the next generation have the responsibility to occupy the economic space in a real sense so that every woman can have a sustainable income. Because once you have a sustainable income, you can make choices, and you have choices. At this point in time, the space and choice is limited, and that's not necessary. 20 years from Beijing, where women developed a platform of action that looked at the equality of men and women and how women should overcome spaces, deficits around political representation, problems around health and all. I think it's actually the Chinese that has a saying that says women hold up half the sky. Because we hold up half the sky, we've got to ensure that we own the part of the earth, not because we inherited this world, this environment, but because we are simply the protectors for the next generation. And we have a responsibility to make the change for the future generation. It's going to be a difficult fight, but we should make it pleasurable. And that's why your show is so important, to ensure that there is that network where women across the continent can hear one another speak.
Thank you so much for sharing those words of wisdom and inspiration to help motivate other young people and older people, women in particular, that are listening to the show.
Thank you so much for joining.
You have been listening to Womanity, Woman in Unity on Channel Africa, the voice of the African Renaissance. And we have been talking to Mrs. Geraldine Fraser-Moliketi, Special Envoy on Gender for the African Development Bank. Tune into the show next week when we speak to Patricia Colbert, Senior Gender Advisor for the UN World Food Programme, and Lee Hilliard, Regional Gender and Protection Advisor, Southern Africa for the UN World Food Programme.